Dr. Vandana Shiva sees issues of diversity playing out not only in our societies, but also in our grocery stores, on our dinner plates, and in the food we eat. Good morning, I'm Gina Kaufman, and today on Central Standard, we sit down with this prolific author to discuss her unique blend of science and philosophy. We'll travel with Dr. Shiva to case studies throughout the globe. We'll also explore her intriguing notion that diversity is crucial to preventing a dangerous mental state, which she calls a monoculture of the mind. Later in the hour, as part of our Tell KCUR series, find out how families throughout the Kansas City area are explaining recent acts of violence to their children. That's just ahead on Central Standard, right after this news. Dr. Vandana Shiva sees issues of diversity playing out. Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and with me today is a woman who in some circles requires no introduction, Vandana Shiva. This environmental scientist, philosopher, and activist is a force of nature in her own right. She's been involved in a number of environmental movements worldwide, she's written several books, and she's ensuring biodiversity in our food supply and beyond. We'll be getting to know Dr. Shiva a whole lot better during this hour. Thanks for being here, Dr. Shiva. It's a pleasure to meet you. I'd like to hear a little bit about you as a person, because I feel like that's the part of the early part of your story is really mysterious to me. First of all, where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in the Himalaya. I was born in Doon Valley, where I've returned after giving up university research and teaching. I was born to parents who had given up, my dad had given up military to become a forest conservator. My mother was trapped on the other side when India and Pakistan became divided in the terrible tragedy of the partition.
When you say she was trapped, what do you mean by that?
Well, we suddenly had a border between us and we had mass killings. 2 million people were killed. And she had to be rescued and brought back. And she was a high-level educational officer. But she decided to become a farmer when she came back to India as a refugee.
Did these experiences, do you think, set the stage for some of your interests in your own adult life?
Well, definitely the way I grew up shaped a lot of the values I had. My parents were committed to Gandhi and Gandhian movements. They were very active. That influenced us. They were committed to simplicity. And that has been the way I've grown up. And I remember a particular time when this horrible nylon fiber was coming in, the first time a synthetic fiber was coming in, and all the girls around me had it. And when my mother asked, what do you want for your birthday? I said, a nylon frock. And she said, I'll get it for you if that's what you want. But remember, when you wear a nylon frock, a rich industrialist gets his next Mercedes car. And if you wear khadi, the hand-spun, hand-woven cloth that Gandhi promoted as part of our freedom struggle, so when you wear khadi, a woman is able to cook a meal for her children that night. You make your choices. And I said, that's my first lesson in political economy.
Yeah, what a lesson. Well, a book you published in the year 2000, Tomorrow's Biodiversity, begins with an intriguing sentence that I'm hoping you can flesh out for us. You write, I was trained as a physicist and had imagined my life would be passed in the company of elementary particles. Take me back to meet the young physicist dreaming of a life studying particles.
Well, only part of my own childhood that wasn't in the context was physics. But from somewhere, that is what inspired me. Einstein inspired me. And from the time I can remember, I just wanted to be like him and study physics. I went to schools that didn't teach physics, but I went to teachers who taught me. I did a master's in physics honors in particle physics in the University of Punjab in Chandigarh. Went on to sign up for a PhD in India on particle physics. But the questions of quantum theory kept coming in my mind. What does it mean for the world? And the physicists don't think too much about it. They just go on with their calculation. And that's what I was told by my guide of that time, a very famous particle physicist called Dr. Samar Biswas. So I started to read where I could and then tracked that all the people who were looking at the foundational questions of physics had been gathered by the University of Western Ontario in Canada in a colloquium on quantum theory.
Talk about quantum theory and what it is about that that really had your mind spinning.
All of us had been brought up in a physics that says the world is made of immutable things, unbreakable, unchangeable, totally deterministic. The only way they influence each other is through contact. It's called action by contact. And this world of fragmentation and separation is the mechanistic Cartesian Newtonian world. But quantum theory gives us a totally different picture. First of all, there are no things in quantum theory. They're potentials. Everything waiting to evolve into something else. That field of potential is the reality. In that field of potential, you can have action at a distance, which is called non-separability, which was the subject of my PhD thesis, non-locality in quantum theory. And the idea was maybe we can break it down into determinism, but it's not reducible to determinism. There will always be indeterminism. So there's non-separability contrary to the Newtonian separation. There's constant change contrary to the immutable particles of mechanical physics. And most importantly, there is a permanent uncertainty.
So you're this young physicist trying to figure out what to do with this information about a world where suddenly there aren't things, there are potentialities, and there aren't immutable forces. There's a constantly shifting, constantly changing, infinite possibilities kind of perspective opening up to you. These days, you're really known as someone who has taken action in the world of environmentalism and agriculture. How do you get from where you were then to where you are now? What was there a moment when your interest in agriculture and environmentalism really opened up to you?
Well, you know, at one level, my quantum worldview has shaped a lot of my ecological thinking, as well as my thinking about food, agriculture, what's the seed, what's the potential of the seed. But there are two moments of transition. The first is my involvement with this beautiful movement called CHIPCO, where women came out and said, we're going to hug the trees. You'll have to kill us before you kill the trees. And this was taking place in my region of the Himalaya, where the Ganges originates.
Can you slow down here and explain to us that movement? Explain to us where it came from, what was going on, and why these people were taking this stance.
Well, as I said, I'd grown up in the Himalayan forest. They looked as stable as the Himalaya themselves. And then we started to have massive commercial logging.
When was this?
In the 70s, partly as a result of the Indochina War of 62, India thought if we build roads all the way to the border, we'll have better defense. Yet those roads became ways of accessing the remaining forests of the Himalaya. And during British times, a lot of accessible forests had been destroyed. For 50 rupees, which is $1, the entire Ganges catchment forest were given to one Mr. Wilson, who devastated it. And then came the road building, which led to extraction. The Himalaya is a very fragile mountain system. It is young. And the forest are its only protection. So when the forests go with our heavy monsoon, we get landslides, we get floods. And that's what was increasing. 72, we had a terrible flood. And it's the women who connected the forests and the flood. And said the forests are not timber mines. They are our soil and water and pure air. Now, that is the teaching. I always say I went to a second university with a second PhD, except that it's not on paper. This doctorate is with the women of CHIPCO, women who've never been to school and college, but amazing teachers of ecological science. That's where I really learned my first lessons of biodiversity. But 84, we had two big disasters in India. The Bhopal disaster, where a pesticide plant leaked and killed 3,000 people immediately, 30,000 since then. It was a plant owned by Union Carbide, now by Dow. The second disaster was the rise of extremism in the state of Punjab, which is where the Green Revolution, the name given to chemical farming in the third world, was first introduced. The Green Revolution was given a Nobel Peace Prize. But in 84, there was a war going on in Punjab. Again, 30,000 people killed.
Explain a little bit. I think that that term green revolution might be confusing to some people because the word green nowadays has connotations about sustainability, local organic. That's a lot of the kinds of stuff we're referring to when we talk about things being green. And you're saying that the green revolution that you're talking about is actually a revolution in incorporating chemical strategies into farming.
It's a tragedy that the word green revolution was given to a transformation that was not green nor revolutionary. It was imposed from the top. It was imposed to spread war chemicals into agriculture because the chemical fertilizers come from the factories that used to make explosives for the war. Pesticides were war chemicals. That's what they were designed to do, kill people. And that's why it's not an accident that Bhopal happened. These are designed to kill people. In Kansas or where Texas, you had a huge explosion in a fertilizer depot. So many of the bombs, Oklahoma bomb is a fertilizer bomb. These are related to wars and killing. And an entire rhetoric, a spin was created that this was going to create prosperity because the new seeds bred for the chemicals would give higher yields. But what I realized when I studied the Green Revolution in 1984 was yields are only focusing on commodities that are traded globally. They're not focusing on a farm. They're not focusing on the output of food and nutrition. So we measure nutrition per acre and health per acre. And when you do that, small farms, urban gardens produce much more than these very fossil fuel intensive, chemical intensive, capital intensive systems, which only provide 30% of the world's food globally. And only 10% of the corn and soya goes for human food directly. The rest is going for biofuel and animal feed. It's not a food system. And I woke up to all of this while studying the Green Revolution in Punjab for the United Nations University. As a result of my book called The Violence of the Green Revolution, I started to get invited to agriculture meetings. And since I am a permanent student, I always want to learn the next step of whatever road I'm traveling. I would go to these meetings, and the real shift of what I do today took place in 87, where at a conference on biotechnology, the old chemical industry was now saying we have to do genetic engineering because it's the only way to start claiming ownership over life through patents. By changing a gene, we can say we've made a novel organism, and this novel organism can now be owned so we can collect rents and royalties from the seed's capacity to renew itself.
We're going to get back to this in just a second, but I need to tell our listeners, you are listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM. I'm Gina Kaufman talking this morning with Dr. Vandana Shiva. She's in town to speak about cultivating diversity, freedom, and hope tonight at Unity Temple on the Plaza and tomorrow at the Johnson County Community College. For event details, go online to cultivatekc.org. And Dr. Shiva, I want to ask you quickly about the title of your lecture, Cultivating Diversity, Freedom, and Hope. What you're talking about agriculture and you're talking about genetic engineering and the role of chemicals in a global agricultural system. What does diversity have to do with that?
Diversity has everything to do with food. In fact, any system that's not a diversified agriculture system is not a food system. It's something else. It is an industrial system producing non-food, food that is not worthy of being eaten. Because food is the diverse nutrients our body needs, the trace elements, the micronutrients, the absence of which is causing huge problems today. Obesity is not about eating too much. It's about eating an imbalanced diet and not having the metabolism regulated. Zinc deficiencies are leading to depression among children. Magnesium deficiencies are leading to attention deficit disorders. Food has become the biggest source of disease and ill health, as well as hunger in today's world, because diversity creates decentralization. Decentralization creates democracy. Monocultures are vital to a chemical industrial system because it's based on external inputs for which a system must be designed as monocultures. Diversified systems are self-organized. They work with inner resources. Monocultures go hand in hand with monopolies and centralization. We have 50% of the food produced in the world being wasted because of this centralization and long-distance transport. And you add to it the other costs to health, to the environment, I think we're talking about something like a $5 trillion waste on a planet, when even a small portion of that spent on community gardens, urban gardens, small farms, putting people back to the land to grow good food, process good food, create local markets, it would solve 75% of the planetary ecological problem, 75% of our public health problem, and 75% of our unemployment problem, which is a serious crisis in the United States, in Europe, and the world.
I want to jump in here because, and I do want to get back to this idea of diversity, but there are people who say that genetic engineering is required in order to create enough food to feed all of the people in the world. How do you respond to that argument?
Well, because I woke up 30 years ago to a phrase called green revolution not being very green, this to me is a repeat of a spin. The technology of genetic engineering is merely moving a gene, usually a toxic gene like the Bacillus thuringiensis BT or a herbicide tolerant gene, into a plant. A toxic gene doesn't create the yield characteristics or the production characteristics of a plant. It just adds a toxic. The yield comes from the original plant material, created either by farmers breeding or by conventional breeding. The second, empirically, it's so clear around the world, genetic engineering has not led to an increase in yields. There's a study done by the Union of Concerned Scientists for the United States, failure to yield. In India, the GMO cotton, which is the only crop allowed in India, the BT cotton, the promise was 1,500 kilograms. The averages are 400 to 500 kilograms per acre. So there is not an increase in yields, but worse, this system, because it is not related to the rights of food of the people, the ability of an ecosystem to produce in a sustainable way, we actually are producing commodities that are not going to give food. The 90% of the corn and soya, as I mentioned, is going to drive cars or torture animals through intensive animal feed. It's not producing more, but even if it did, it wouldn't remove the hunger. It would aggravate the crisis of hunger and definitely aggravate the crisis of malnutrition and disease that is related to an imbalanced agriculture.
I definitely want to get back to this idea of biodiversity and the role that it plays here and the idea of diversity in general. You've written a book called The Monocultures of the Mind, and I find this concept of diversity versus monoculture and how it applies to very different contexts really intriguing. You talk about a syndrome that you call TINA, there is no alternative. And you argue that having greater diversity creates a wealth of options. And you argue that decreasing diversity creates situations where we have to take less than ideal actions because the argument goes, this is our only choice. Can you give an example of a place that you have visited or studied where the absence of alternatives or the unwillingness to acknowledge alternatives, one of those things, has resulted in an action that everyone acknowledged was not for the best?
Well, in the area of agriculture, we can see clearly how monocultures of the mind have shaped monoculture agriculture systems, which are non-sustainable in terms of nutrition per acre. They're actually declining food availability. They're destroying livelihood options in farming and food systems. And worse, they're creating 40% of the greenhouse gases, which are now giving us the climate disasters. The drought that has been seen in the United States, and I was just reading in the paper this morning, 38% increase in food prices and meat prices because of the drought. We are seeing a vicious circle of all kinds of negative impacts. But a monoculture of the mind in the economic system is what has led to corporate globalization, a phenomena through which corporations wrote the rules of trade. Monsanto wrote the rules of intellectual property rights and agriculture. Cargill wrote the rules of agriculture trade. We have a system that's been created which has, in effect, destroyed the economies of the world. It led to the economy of the U.S. collapsing in 2008 with the Wall Street collapse. Trigger effects were felt in Europe. Half of Europe's youth in southern countries of Greece, of Italy, of Spain, of Portugal, and I work with both with governments and communities in these countries, they are unemployed. We are facing a huge, huge crisis. A monoculture of the mind makes it look like the only market there is the globalized market controlled by the global giants, whereas the real markets and the real economies are the economies of nature, local economies. That is where local food systems are becoming the solution to the multiple crises created by the monocultures of the mind. But the real problem with the monoculture of the mind, it's based on abstractions. So we began with a market economy, and now the market economy is a finance economy 70 times bigger than the real goods and services, $3 trillion mysteriously moving around every day. And this is creating investor rights. Investor rights are based on fictitious money, destroying the real rights of the earth, of the pollinators, of the plants, of the rivers, of people, of communities.
In a lot of the arguments that you've just made, that you reference a lot of very complex global and national situations that people have attributed a number of different reasons to. But in your worldview, it seems to me that things like colonialism, economics, and science all kind of coalesce into one consideration. Can you explain that a little bit? How are, for example, feminism, issues of poverty and wealth, and colonialism all kind of, how do you see these as related?
Well, this is where my training in non-separability and non-fragmentation really comes in. So much of the edifice that we treat as natural today, of divided silos in our thought, are really born of the same project of establishing an empire of man over the earth and lesser creatures, as was called. Now, lesser creatures include all of biodiversity and other species, but it also includes women, defined as a second sex, indigenous people, often defined as non-humans. The colonial project was based on the science of colonization, the science of mechanistic takeover of the universe. It is based on an economics seeing only colonial trade as the basis of economic improvement. So the fact that Native Americans left the bison free was treated as primitiveness. The fact that the Aboriginal people of Australia harvested food was treated as primitiveness. Control, mastery, conquest were defined as human progress. That has shaped the economic paradigm, sadly, because that economic paradigm has led us to this idea of the GDP, the gross domestic product, which only measures what is commercialized and commodified. The definition is, if you produce what you consume, you don't produce. And on the other hand, it has led to a science which declares nature is dead, whereas the earth is very alive. Women became part of what was colonized in this process. Women's knowledge was treated as not knowledge or dangerous. Most of the witches were actually the very learned women of their times. The witch hunts were part of this process. And that's why I talk about the ecological liberation of the earth and species on the planet and women's liberation as being part of a process of a common liberation of life from this death wish that is built into the empire of man.
Take us back to, let's get this back to some specifics, because we're kind of, we're dealing in so many areas and so many abstractions, and it might be helpful to bring it back in a little bit. So let's go to the CHIPCO movement, because that is a place where you were explaining this was very much a women's environmental movement. So maybe that would be a good place to illustrate a little bit of where your ideas come from about the relationship between gender, colonialism, and environmentalism.
Forests in most cultures, including my own in India, have been treated as sacred. And in fact, our Nobel laureate Tagore wrote that India is a forest civilization. We are an Aranya Sanskriti, a culture that comes from the forest, from the diversity of the forest, from the life of the forest. And that's where the diversity of our society has been shaped. And that's how India learned to be democratic, because we learned our democracy from the forest. The women of CHIPCO in the 70s rose up and reminded us what a forest is, that it is a community of living beings. It is not a timber mine, because the colonial enterprise had redefined forest to be mines for timber. Forestry itself was redefined from being an understanding of the ecosystem of the forest to being a maximization of exploitation of uniform trees with uniform yields of monocultures, what was of value in the marketplace. Exactly the same thing has been done to agriculture, where agriculture as a diversity of species working in cooperation, producing more food in the process, has been reduced to a monoculture system based on external inputs, producing a few commodities. This has actually led to a decline in food and nutrition availability instead of an improvement.
You mentioned that in the context of this movement, there was on the one side viewing the forests as a source of timber, and on the other side of viewing the forests as something alive, something different. That sets the stage for this idea that what is the role of economic growth in considering the value of something? And I hate to be susceptible to this there is no alternative syndrome, but is there an alternative to thinking about economics, to thinking about economic growth in these contexts?
So let's go back to the roots of the term economics. It comes from oikos, which means our home. It was supposed to be the management of the household. And ecology was supposed to be the science of the household. As long as they worked together, reinforcing each other, we had sustainable economies. Today, economy has been separated from its root in our home, the planet, as well as real homes where people feed themselves, look after themselves, and build community. Aristotle had a word for economia, the art of living. He had another word for art of money making. He called it chrematistics. Now, we think there is no alternative to GDP and growth, but it's a very recent construction. GDP was created for the war in order to release resources for mobilizing for the warfare, buying more fighter jets, tanks, getting bigger armies. And that's why the definition, if you produce what you consume, you don't produce, was created, which meant all the work to produce sustenance was defined as zero. All of nature's work was defined as zero. Between the war and now, we can see the devastation of the planet by following a false measure of growth called GDP. The Kingdom of Bhutan gave up GDP. The king said, we are not going to chase this illusion. And they said, we won't measure GDP, but we'll measure gross national happiness. I'm very proud to work with the Kingdom of Bhutan to help them in a transition to 100% organic Bhutan. There are alternatives and they are thriving worldwide.
We're going to talk more about Bhutan and the alternative it represents when we come back. We're going to have to take a short break, but when we come back, we will be taking your calls. You can start calling us at 816-235-2888. Your questions and more after the break. Good morning and welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this morning I'm speaking with a prominent thinker and prolific author, Dr. Vandana Shiva. Dr. Shiva has been at the forefront of sustainability in agriculture, but her message goes way beyond agriculture. She speaks about diversity, freedom, and hope tonight and tomorrow in Kansas City. Do you have questions for Dr. Shiva? Give us a ring at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And Dr. Shiva, right before the break, we were talking about Bhutan and its establishment of gross domestic happiness instead of gross domestic product. Could you tell us a little bit more about Bhutan?
Well, Bhutan is a small kingdom in the Himalaya, and it decided that it was not going to allow itself to be trashed like the rest of the world has, where nature is destroyed to increase growth. But every time you cut a tree and destroy a forest, you have growth, but no forest, no rivers, no livelihoods. Bhutan has committed itself to keep 70% of its land under forests. That is part of its sustainability commitment. But the other part of its sustainability commitment is that they realize that chemical agriculture is an agriculture based on poisons. They have watched what happened to India. first with the Green Revolution and now with the seed monopolies and globalization and GM seeds, where the seed dependence has pushed 284,000 Indian farmers to suicide. They don't want to go that way. And that's why they've asked us to help make a transition to 100% organic Bhutan. We organized an amazing scientific congress in March for all the mountain systems of the world, from the Alps and the Rockies and the highlands of Ethiopia to the Andes, because the commitment of Bhutan is a commitment that every place should start repeating, to shift the paradigm of economics, to measure the well-being of people, not the profits of the oligarch, which is what growth hides very often. Wherever growth is high, oligarchy is also becoming very, very high. The second is to shift from a fragmented science to an ecological science, a better understanding of the relationships within ecosystems and between nature and people, and how healthy ecosystems mean healthy people.
You've been using the word we, and I wonder if you can explain who is we. When Bhutan is asking you to help, who are they asking?
Well, they're asking me as a person, as a scientist, but also my team of Navdanya, the movement I started in 1987 when I heard the corporations talk about patenting life and owning life through genetic engineering. That's the day I decided I would be a seed saver. That's the day I decided I would go across the country and find every little seed and rescue it and save it and grow it. We have a wonderful team of committed peasants and farmers and scientists. 110 community seed banks have been created. We have trained more than 750,000 farmers to shift to ecological agriculture. And we've established a fair trade network so that these amazing forgotten foods, foods that we'd stopped eating, the diversity of rices, we grow 3,000 now. We've saved 3,000 seeds of rice. We used to have 200,000 rice varieties. In that diversity is the wealth of nature. In that diversity is wealth for people. Farmers using native seeds and growing ecological agriculture and shaping the market through fair trade are earning 10 times more than farmers growing GMO BT cotton or hybrid rice or hybrid corn.
You talked about training 500,000 farmers, so hundreds of thousands of farmers. Have you gotten to meet many of them and understand what has motivated them to get involved in this project?
Well, yeah, I meet most of them. I travel the country. I spend a lot of time going to different parts of India. And then we have built up on a farm in Dehradun in Doon Valley, a teaching center, which has become the Earth University, where people come from around the country. Sometimes farmers will come because they're running out of water and they can't afford to do Green Revolution agriculture, which requires 10 times more water.
Why does your farm require less water?
Because we save seeds that are not thirsty seeds. Green Revolution seeds are bred for chemicals and require a lot of water. We save seeds of millets that require 10 times less water. 250 millimeters is all they require compared to 2,500 millimeters for chemical paddy. We have rice varieties that are unirrigated, that can grow in a drought condition. But we have rice varieties that can tolerate salt, so that when cyclones come, and they are increasing with climate change, farmers have access to seed they can grow in spite of the salt on their land. Organic soils hold much more water. So if you're farming organically, you can have a drought, but you won't have a crop failure.
When you first start working with a farmer, is there something that comes up again and again, perhaps, that like a farmer wants to get involved, but there's some source of reluctance?
Well, the two sources of reluctance come from the brainwashing of the industrial agricultural propaganda. The first is, without chemicals, we won't be able to grow enough food. So we say to them, do your own experiment. Put a quarter of your land under organic. And in your experiment, find out if it actually makes you lose. We'll compensate if there's a loss. But they always earn more. But the second is the propaganda that I earn more. So we say, okay, let's sit and do the calculations. You grow this kind of crop. How much chemical do you use? How much water do you use? What are the price of the product you get? It's that mysterious increase of money. A a farmer who's growing nine crops, which is what Navdanya means, nine seeds, nine crops together. It's like the three sisters of the Native Americans, the corn, the beans, the squash, the milpa of Mexico. In that system, you have more food, but only a little part of the corn is sold. But when you trash your diversity and turn it into a monoculture and sell it all, you think you're earning more, but you forget you're spending 10 times more, because industrial agriculture is a negative system in energy, 10 kilocalories to produce 1 kilocalorie of food, and in finance, usually 10 times more spent on inputs, which is why family farms are disappearing, which is why farms are getting mortgaged, which is why even in the United States, farmland is now owned by Wall Street and not by farmers.
Where do seeds figure into all of this? Talk about saving seeds and talk about what your work just at the ground level really entails.
Well, seed is the beginning of food. It's when you plant a seed, you get a crop. And in the law of the seed, some of the crop you should be able to save for the next season's planting, because seed is the source of reproduction. Seed is the source of fertility. Seed is the source of renewal. Seed holds its own reproduction in it. The entire idea of patenting seed to make it illegal for farmers to save their own seeds is a forced imposition of an artificial idea that seed is an invention. So very wrong. Seed is not invented. If I put a toxic gene into your body, I will be sued for harming you.
Yeah, but that's a different model.
But corporations put a toxic seed into a plant and are rewarded with intellectual property rights, not just for that one seed, for generations ahead. The famous case of Bauman versus Monsanto in this country, where Bauman bought grain from an elevator and planted it, and he was sued because this is intellectual property right. I think this is an error that needs correction. And that's why, for me, Navdanya is about defending the freedom of the seed to evolve. My quantum training has allowed me to see the reality of the seed, that seed is a potential. Seed is not a thing. Seed as potential is waiting to evolve to give us more, because seed can increase its yield. It doesn't have a fixed yield. It responds according to the love you give it, the fertility your soil has, and it has the capacity to adapt to a changing climate. When you treat seed as an engineered artifact, an invention, you make its resilience come down. It collapses. One disease and it's over in that monoculture. One climate havoc, finished. You don't have a crop. We need the seeds of diversity. We need the seeds of resilience. And in Navdanya, we've saved thousands of seeds. But most important, we've recovered seed as a commons, because seed is not a private property. It is a commons of life. It is a commons of community. And it must become once again the commons of a food security system.
The idea of intellectual property and seeds is really interesting. We'll get back to that, hopefully. But let's turn now to one of our callers who wants to hear from you. And we'll just go turn to her now. Sonia, good morning.
First of all, I love this show. And I'm glad you have Professor Shiva as a guest, because I don't understand this problem of genetic farming. And I was thinking about the honeybees. I was reading, I think a couple of years ago on the Time magazine, about honeybees are dying off. Is there any way that Professor Shiva can explain to us what would happen if all the honeybees are killed? That's what I meant to say.
Well, Einstein, my inspiration, said, when the last bee goes, humanity will
disappear.
Einstein
said that.
75% of the honeybees have disappeared, but 75% of the monarch butterfly is gone. The combination of Bt toxin crops, which have Bt toxin in their pollen, is killing our pollinators. Studies done at Cornell University showed this. But Roundup-resistant crops are killing the milkweed, which the butterfly needs. So between the two families of Bt crops and HT crops, which we could call poison-producing plants, our pollinators are being threatened. The United Nations has assessed 159 billion dollars is the service the pollinators give for free to create a food system. A seed needs a pollinator to give the next generation. We are destroying the very foundations of our food.
Can I ask you a question about genetic modification and genetic engineering? Because I'm kind of thinking back on my own very early biology classes. I'm by no means an expert, but the concept of artificial selection has been around for a long time. And it seems like I don't know entirely where sort of fairly early methods of selecting for characteristics that are valuable for whatever reason in a crop, where that becomes something that we then call genetic engineering, genetic modification. Can you delineate sort of where one ends and the other begins, or is it all engineering?
No. Farmers have bred seed through selection for centuries. 10,000 years is what the assessment is, that farmers have farmed for centuries. And mostly women were the ones who started domestication of plants and selected. Teosinte was a wild plant, has given us the hundreds of varieties of corn. Oryza sativa was a wild grass, has given us the 200,000 rices that peasants bred in India. Then you had crossing. And crossing was what is called artificial selection, only because you didn't leave it to the bees to pollinate. You chose what you will cross with what. Genetic engineering begins with the tools of recombinant DNA, the ability to take genes across species barriers, which is why a soil organism, BT, the gene for toxin, can be put into a corn or into a cotton. In a similar way, new experiments are being done to put human genes into animal, fish genes into tomato, small scorpion genes into cabbage. These are the trans-species movements. An entire genome works together when you cross a species because the intelligence of that plant is at work. Now you assume that the plant has zero intelligence. It's just these immutable genes, atoms of the plant. And you shoot with a gene gun using the gene that you want to introduce.
But so when you're manipulating sort of internally at the genetic level?
Not just internally at the genetic level, but introducing genes that aren't part of that organism. But because it's an inaccurate system, you add an antibiotic resistance marker to separate the successful transformation from the unsuccessful one. So every transgenic food has antibiotic resistance genes in it. And then you add viral promoters to express the trait you want to express. We are adding genes of crops, of species that don't belong to the crops. We are adding genes of antibiotic resistance. We are adding genes of viruses into our food system. And this is what we say needs to be assessed as a whole, as an interactive system.
We have a couple of callers who have been getting off the line because they want to keep listening to you. So I'm going to share their questions. Susan wants to know if you've spoken with Wes Jackson at the Land Institute in Salina, Kansas. He's been studying the difficulty of monocultures locally for years.
Yes, Wes is a very dear friend. His work on perennials is extremely important.
We've also heard from Michael, who says, you talk of the solution of the monoculture mindset being to move to a local green food production. I am in full agreement, but become flummoxed at thinking of a way to make the initial cost of the transition economically viable.
The transition from a globalized system to local food system, from a poison-based system of industrial agriculture to a health-giving system of ecological farming, those transitions are being made everywhere. We are doing it in India through Navdanya. Here in Kansas City, Cultivate Kansas is doing it. It has to be a collective community effort. It can't be left to the young unemployed person.
Well, it is time to give up this conversation with Dr. Vandana Shiva. If you want to hear more from her, go to cultivatekc.org and get information about the two lectures she'll be delivering tonight and tomorrow. That website again is cultivatekc.org. Thanks so much for being here, Dr. Shiva. I've really learned a lot and I hope our listeners have too.
Thank you.
Well, now we've got Tell KC You Are.
Why don't you talk? Why don't you talk to me?
Tell KCUR is a weekly segment where our listeners tell us what they think. This week, we asked you how you talk to children about violent incidents that might have affected people they know and that they might be hearing about on the news, at the dinner table, or at school. Here to share your responses to that question is KCUR's Allison Rawlitz. Allison has been listening to your voicemails, reading the emails you've been sending, and your tweets. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Gina.
So you brought in some audio from a voicemail that the station received, and we're going to play that in a minute. But what is it about this phone call that really captivated you?
Well, Gina, this call actually came in, I think, late yesterday, and it really sums up what we've been hearing from listeners. So I'd really just like to go ahead and play it. You're going to hear from Brooke. She's a caller in Overland Park who has three children, ages 7, 12, and 14.
My husband and I were at the Jewish Community Center right after it happened because we had tickets for a play that day. And the young man is the same exact age as my daughter and also volunteers at the same church she volunteers at. So it did hit close to home for us. The most pressing question they ask is why, and I don't feel that we're really prepared to answer that. We talk about how people have mental illness and they're not right in their head, and we can't have any rhyme or reason about why they do things or how. And we talk about how things happen suddenly like this and can completely change your family's life through no fault of your own, and that's why you have to live every day and don't have regrets and don't put off things, because you never know when it is your last time.
That's a powerful message, and possibly quite frightening on some level, but is this in line with what other people are saying? Are there recurring themes you're hearing?
Sure, yes. And I guess I just would like to make clear that this question, you know, we really wanted to know about any community tragedy, but this really came in light and after the Johnson County shootings over the weekend. And so there were a lot of people that were just sharing messages of love with children. I'm going to go ahead and read a few if that's okay.
Of course.
KC Metro Moms on Twitter, they tweeted us, "We believe all kids should know about the power hate can carry, but realize that the power of love is far greater. Teach kids love." And we heard something very similar from this woman named Jennifer, and she's a pastor in the Kansas City area. She tweeted us, "I told them sometimes people are filled with hate, but more people are filled with love. Whether we live or die, we belong to God." And there were really just several messages like that, Gina.
Kids must be really curious about the person who would do something like this. What are people telling kids about the perpetrator?
Well, it was really interesting. We had a few folks tweet and Facebook in that this person is really just sick. Michael on Facebook said, unfortunately, there are people in the world who are sick and don't seek out or receive treatment. And, you know, actually, when you step back, that could be a really effective way to talk to a child.
Did we hear from experts in our community on this?
We heard from Kelly McCauley. She works at KVC Health Systems. And for those that aren't familiar, it's a child welfare and mental health agency in Olathe. And they actually have a lot of experience helping kids with trauma.
What kinds of did she leave advice for our listeners?
Yeah, she had some really just practical tips. She said it's really important to ask children what they're seeing and hearing, for instance, on the media, on the TV, on the radio and newspapers, and then asking them what they feel. She said it's really important to listen to them, give the child some space and really listen to what they're saying. And then it's really important to step in and correct them and help them understand what's going on.
So making sure that there's not some major misunderstanding about what's happening.
Sure, and no confusion.
Well, this is a pretty scary thing, even for adults. And of course, there's a memorial service going on right now, or perhaps
right as
just
we're speaking,
letting out.
Yes.
Yeah. But did anyone talk about how to reassure children who might be frightened? Because even adults, you know, are very frightened.
Sure. We actually had a caller earlier this week. She referred us to a letter from Laura Bush. And the letter, we ended up looking it up. It's addressed to children, and it's called What Happened on 9/11. And we read through the letter, and a lot of it is, you know, just very encouraging and soothing words that a child might understand. But the focus that we really liked was she just recommends emphasizing to children that there are adults here. There are a lot of people here to take care of you, and we're making sure that you're going to be safe.
Well, thanks so much, Allison. Is there anything else from this experience of collecting all of these responses that we haven't gotten to that you'd like to bring up?
No, just I mean that even this morning we kept getting more responses from people, and it was just very, very touching to see how, as adults are really looking for answers, it was touching to see how they're kind of stepping back and trying to break this down for children.
Well, thank you so much, Allison. Allison is with KCUR's community engagement team, and she has been part of this Tell KCUR segment that we do every week. She'll be putting another question out there for you through social media and on the air very soon. So stay tuned for that and participate in these conversations. Thanks for being here, Allison.
Thank you, Gina.
People have also been sending the station messages of love to share with the victims' families, and we received more of those than we have time to read. But I'll go ahead and leave you with one of them. Andrea White from Maryland, in fact, writes, "We are all worthy human beings deserving of everything life has to offer. Love is the only thing that can overcome all the hatred in the world. I am sorry for your loss. I hope these precious lives were not taken in vain and instead will inspire people to choose love and reject hate in their honor." You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows on the Central Standard page of kcur.org. That's kcur.org/Central Standard. Tune in tomorrow as the food critics lead a search for the best places to grab lunch in and around Kansas City. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Christy Garten. Jenny Witte has been our announcer today. Up to Date is next with a conversation about the original Tornado Chasers. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR.